Joy Davidman was a flawed human being, just like me, just like you, just like everybody who's listening to the sound of my voice right now.
Welcome to All About Jack, a C.S. Lewis podcast. I'm William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com. You've not likely heard of my guest today. In fact, there is a chance you might not even be familiar with the topic I'm discussing. Let me reveal the title of the book first, which will clarify things. It's called Joy. Well, the subtitle will clarify things. That subtitle is Poet, Seeker, and the Woman Who Captivated C.S. Lewis. The title comes from Abigail Santa Maria, and this is her debut release. But I'm sure it won't be her last, and when you read this book, you'll know why. Welcome to the show, Miss Santa Maria.
Thanks so much for having me. Please call me Abby.
Okay, I certainly will. Thanks, Abby. Well, now, I'll have you share about yourself in a little bit. Let's start out with this, and I'm playing the devil's advocate. Why does it matter who Joy Davidman was, after all? Do spouses of famous people really matter?
Spouses of accomplished writers matter, of course, because they inevitably, to a lesser or greater degree, influence the writing of their spouse. In Joy's case, she influenced Lewis's book, Oh Hell, that she read the proofs, and he thanks her in the acknowledgments, the English literature in the 16th century book. Then she worked on Surprised by Joy, typing it up and helping with edits. And of course, Till We Have Faces, it was an idea, Lewis's novel, that he had been working on for many decades before he met Joy, but had not found the right form for. And it was over whiskey one night at the Kilns that they batted around some ideas, and Till We Have Faces was conceived. And then they worked on every chapter together. Joy's fingerprints are all over that book. And the Four Loves, of course, and A Grief Observed, we wouldn't have without Joy. But Joy also matters for herself. She herself was an accomplished writer. She was the 1938 Yale Younger Poets Award recipient, prestigious poetry award here in the U.S. that still continues today. And she wrote two novels, Anya and Weeping Bay, and she wrote a book of nonfiction, Smoke on the Mountain. And she also wrote dozens and dozens and dozens of film reviews and book reviews for the communist Marxist magazine New Masses in the late 30s and early 40s.
Well, now, let me have you tell about yourself by virtue of also explaining how you got interested in doing a biography on Joy.
Well, I was working on my master's thesis, my master's of fine arts in nonfiction writing at Columbia University, and I was reading a lot of C.S. Lewis at the time and had, you know, for many years read Lewis, but was back digging into his work. And I read Mere Christianity, and then I read A Grief Observed, and the juxtaposition of Lewis's tone and demeanor and even the content of those two books blew me away. You know, in Mere Christianity, he's logical and he's reasoned and he's strong, and it's such a powerful, brilliant, brilliant work. But maybe if there's anything that's missing, it's kind of the emotion and the passion of humanity. And then I read A Grief Observed, and he was like Lewis. It was like Lewis was, you know, a modern day psalmist, and he was, you know, devastated and broken at the loss of his wife. And I was moved by how he talked about her mind being lithe and quick as a leopard. And I wanted to know more about who this woman was whose loss could shake him. And I loved the way that he talked about her mind and about their love for each other. And so I found Lyle Dorset's book about Joy, and I wanted to know more. I just wanted to know more. And through Lyle's book, I learned that Joy had attended Columbia University for her own master's degree. And because I was working on my master's thesis, I knew that graduate students were required to deposit a finished copy of the thesis with the library archives. And I wondered if that same policy stood in 1935 when Joy did her master's degree. I was writing in the library my thesis, and the cornerstone of the library says 1935, the very year that Joy did her master's there. So I went to the reference desk and I asked, and they typed something into the computer and they said, yes, we do have a master's thesis by Joy Davidman from 1935. And it was in the offsite annex, and I put in an order for it. And 2 days later, went back to the reference desk, and they pulled out this huge tome and handed it to me. And it was the very same typescript that Joy herself had typed all those years ago. And as far as I was able to discern, nobody had ever thought to request it. And this was in... this was either the fall of 2002 or early 2003. And I thought, if this is here and nobody's ever thought to look for it, and I'm in New York City where Joy was from, where she grew up and where she spent her young adulthood and the beginning of her first marriage, what else might be all around me? What other material, what other people who haven't been interviewed, what other letters that might be sitting in somebody's closet or attic or basement? And so I started looking around, and every stone I turned over, there was something there. And every person I talked to said, you should talk to so-and-so who might have known her. You should talk to so-and-so who was a friend or not a friend, you know, or a colleague. Or I would be, you know, I would call somebody up and meet with them, and they would say, oh, you know, I might have some letters from her in a box in the back of my closet. Would you like to see them? You know, and just one thing kept leading to another.
Even though we haven't gotten into the content of your book, simply called Joy, how is it different or similar to what's been published previously about her?
I attempted to write a real portrait of a real human being, a real woman. One thing I said to nearly everyone I interviewed was, my intention is to neither demonize nor idealize Joy. And I think that much of what's been done before has tended to err on one side or the other. And I really tried to take a more balanced, nuanced approach. And my book also goes much deeper than anything before into her pre-Lewis years, beginning with her family history, delving into her development as a writer, growth as a writer, her deepest internal longings, the facts of her life, the brief stint she did in Hollywood for 6 months as a junior screenwriter for MGM, her involvement in the Communist Party, her involvement in Dianetics, which hasn't ever been known or understood before. It was known that her first husband, Bill, was involved, but I found letters in which Joy herself talks about how deeply involved she was in practicing and studying Dianetics. So it's both her humanity as well as the facts of her life and a thorough treatment of her life story and narrative that I go deeper into than what I had seen before.
In your introduction, you note that you wanted to, quote, a more thorough look at pre-Lewis years and a more balanced treatment of her story. And also that Lewis stated, for those who have read in A Grief Observed, that Joy, quote, was not a perfect saint, close quote. In fact, she was, quote, a sinful woman married to a sinful man. Now, in terms of your book here, it might be say that you present a unsanitized portrait of Joy, and some may not like that. So why did you choose to do it that way?
I look at the Bible as a compendium of biographies written by God, who was the great biographer. And when God wrote the stories of his people, he didn't clean up their lives. He gave us these stories of the people who he loved in all of their complexity, in all of their sinful humanity, in all of their flawed humanness, in order, in large part, to show us the purpose of grace and redemption. And I really don't believe that it does anybody any favors to portray a sanitized version of another human being. That story, that perfect life was already written, and his name is Jesus. Joy Davidman was a flawed human being, just like me, just like you, just like everybody who's listening to the sound of my voice right now. I really believe that part of the job of a good biographer is to make some sense of the messiness of another person's life in order to help herself, himself, and all the readers to make sense and better understand the messiness in their own lives. And, you know, I so strongly do not believe in hagiography, this elevation of people into saints. I think it's sort of a problem in Christian biographies too. We all want heroes, you know, we all do. And, but a hero is not some, but it's not a person who's perfect. There's just no such thing. So, I wanted to write about a real person, and that doesn't mean that I set out searching for her flaws. In fact, if anything, I didn't come to this understanding of biography and of humanity, of the importance of writing a humanized portrait, until I was starting to come across more and more flaws in Joy's life, and trying to make sense of what do I believe and what do I want to say? What do I want to write about Joy? Do I want to really write her story and really write the truth? Or do I want to leave out things that are a little unsavory so that we can continue to have this false but idealized portrait of her, you know? And I wanted to write the truth.
Well, now you touch on Joy's parents in your biography that I'm not sure I caught in other people's material. Tell us some about their background and how her early home environment shaped her.
Joy's parents, Joseph and Jeanette, were Eastern European immigrants. They came to this country in the 1890s as small children. They moved to the Lower East Side, and they lived in relative squalor in poor housing conditions and in what was called the Jewish ghetto, and they also faced anti-Semitism. And the way out was education and hard work and assimilation. And they both got college educations. They both became teachers. Joy's father got his PhD in 1917 when Joy was two, and became a principal. And he wanted to become a superintendent, but he didn't pass a school superintendent, and largely because of his tyrannical personality, which I'll get to in a second. But because of their desperation to fit in and to get away from the squalor of their childhood and to assimilate and to be accepted in society that considered them outcasts in many ways, they drilled into their children that because they were Jewish, they had to work twice as hard. And they pushed both their children, Joy and her younger brother, Howard, very hard to succeed. They gave them supplementary homework and tests during summer vacations. As it was, Joy was a sickly child. She had a lot of illnesses when she was a child, and that took her away from school for long stretches of time. So between that and the way that her parents expected her to study and to be an overachiever by doing all this extra work in her spare time, Joy didn't have a tremendous social life, and she didn't have the opportunity to really develop social skills with peers the way that so many of her classmates did. And I think that really shaped how she interacted with people as an adult. She's often portrayed as a brash, brassy New Yorker, but I'm a New Yorker and I'm a little brash and brassy, and so many New Yorkers are. But Joy went beyond that. She wasn't a congenial person, and she wasn't
easy to get along with, even by the standards of New Yorkers. And I think a lot of that had to do with how her home environment shaped her. Her father was a bully. And I know this because Joy's niece, the daughter of her brother Howard, has many, many, many family papers and documents and letters in her possession that she opened up to me that had been sitting in her attic in boxes. And among those papers are many letters and professional documents having to do with Joy's father's career as principal, as a junior high school principal. And I found many letters of resignation from people who could not bear to work under him, who said that he ruled with an iron fist. And I was so struck by this because I thought if adults cannot work under him, cannot bear to work under him in a professional context and environment, what must he have been like at home with his children? And that gave me great compassion for Joy too, because she didn't have the luxury of the option to resign or to ask to be transferred to another home the way so many teachers under Dr. Davidman, as he insisted everyone call him, you know, were able to request transfers to other schools because they wanted a new principal. And so I was really struck by reading his letters, things that he wrote. He wrote many editorials to newspapers because he felt he was the only one who could correct the mistakes that everyone else was making. And some of them weren't mistakes. It was just he had a different opinion that he believed was absolute fact. And then he would be angry with editors who didn't include the letters that he wrote, you know, in response to all these newspaper articles that he thought were so flawed. So that was very telling to me, and it really raised a lot of flags and just told me a lot about what Joy had to put up with and made me understand why she sought sanctuary in the written page, in writing and in reading.
In your book, which again, if people haven't caught the fact that it's just simply called Joy, you provide an interesting account of her finishing an undergraduate degree in her teens and then a master's degree by age 20. What are some of the most interesting things about these periods in her life?
Well, like I said, Joy's parents pushed her very hard. And one of the things they believed was that children should be educated based by grade placement, based on aptitude, not based on age. So Joy was 14 when she graduated from high school. She was 15 when she started college, which is extremely young by today's standards. But by standards of those days, most freshmen in Joy's freshman class at Hunter College were 15 or 16 years old. So it was much more common in those days for people to start young. But it was extraordinary for a Jewish woman in 1935 to be getting a master's degree. It was the Depression. The Depression happened. The stock market crashed in the fall of 29 when Joy was finishing high school, and Joy began college in the fall of 1930 at Hunter College in New York City. And she was there from 1930 to 1934, which was the height of the Depression. And it was a time when, you know, like most Americans, even then, even though it was the Depression, she was kind of living in a college bubble, and she was young and romantic. And at the end of her senior year in 1934, she was standing by a window, looking out the window, and she happened to see a young woman on the roof across the way of another building, and it was a classmate of hers, and the girl jumped and died. She committed suicide because she her parents had died, and there was just a money problem, and she was desperate, and like so many other people during those years, she jumped off a roof. And
that snapped Joy out of the bubble, and that was a big shaping force that led her to think more about what was going on around her, the social and political context in which she was living, and what she might need to do about it. And ultimately, after a few more years went by and a lot of other things happened, she joined the Communist Party of the United States of America and became a card-carrying communist.
Next, I'd like to explore how did Joy meet her first husband, Bill Gresham, and what was their marriage really like?
Well, how exactly Joy and Bill first met isn't known, but they both were involved in an organization called the League of American Writers. Joy's poetry at the time heavily focused on Spanish Civil War and on her politics, and Bill shared her politics. He was also a member of the Communist Party, and he had also fought in the Spanish Civil War. He had volunteered as a soldier to go to Spain and to fight for the people. And this cause was central to Joy's career, her passions, her core ideologies at the time. So Bill was kind of a hero. You know, he had taken up of his own will. He hadn't been drafted, and he had gone over. He had fought, you know, for this cause that Joy believed in so strongly. And so it was after his return that they met, and they were both teaching at the League of American Writers, which offered some courses in poetry and in fiction writing. And the League strongly believed that writers had a responsibility to change the world through their writing. And many in the League, though not all, were members of the Communist Party. And it was a very, very leftist organization. Everybody who was anybody in American literary circles in the late 30s was a member of the League of American Writers, which began its collapse after the Hitler-Stalin Pact happened in 1939, and there was a big split. But at the time, the conferences were they had biannual conferences that were attended by everyone, every great name in American literature who was writing at the time. And Joy was a very well-known poet. She won the Yale Younger Poets Award, and Stephen Vincent Benet mentored her, and he was a Pulitzer Prize winning poet whose name is not very familiar to people today. But so that's how very likely Joy and Bill met. And they got married within a couple days after he had been married for quite a while before Joy, but that marriage, he hadn't lived with that wife in quite a while, and it was just a matter of getting the divorce finalized on paper, which he did. And once the divorce came through, he and Joy got married a couple days later, and their marriage was very happy at first and for a while. Joy called him, quote, the mythical perfect husband, and she'd never met anyone like him. He was gregarious. He told lots of stories. He sang. He was the life of every party. And most people I met who I interviewed who knew both of them adored him. Almost everyone, in fact, spoke very highly of Bill Gresham. And so did Joy at first.
I'm sorry to say that I have to break in here and end this first of a two-part episode for a book due out on August the 4th, simply entitled Joy. In the next show, we'll learn some of what went wrong in Joy's first marriage before she became divorced, and how she got to know Lewis and ultimately marry him. If you are listening to this more than a week after it was released at the end of July 2015, then you can go online now to catch the next part. If you are, however, hearing this sooner than that, you'll have to wait until August 3rd for the second installment. Either way, thanks for listening to this episode of All About Jack, a feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty, your host. Be sure to check the show notes for a direct link to Abby's website, Facebook author page, and her Twitter account. I'll also have a link in the notes to help you quickly buy the book. You can find the show notes by either going to EssentialCSLewis.com or AllAboutJack.podbean.com. The Podbean location is where the audio of each episode is hosted, and browsing previous programs is a little easier there. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. Again, that's AllAboutJack.podbean.com. If you, however, go to EssentialCSLewis.com, at that location, you can still get this podcast. Plus, I have a variety of articles there as well, including a daily fact, quote, and quiz about C.S. Lewis. I hope you enjoyed today's show enough to want to share it. Also, feel free to leave comments about the program online at EssentialCSLewis.com or at AllAboutJack.podbean.com. As noted, either place is where you can find the other programs. Recent shows include talking with Carolyn Curtis on a book she co-edited called Women and C.S. Lewis. And I also recently did a chat with Dr. Devin Brown about the Eric Metaxas-hosted video that's entitled Discussing Mere Christianity. There's also a study guide that Dr. Brown wrote. Older programs include a two-part show with Dr. Bruce Edwards about the four-volume set C.S. Lewis, Life, Works, and Legacy. And another older show from several months back is with Dr. David Downing about the Pilgrim's Regress, Wade Annotated Edition. Again, you can hear those and other programs by either going to EssentialCSLewis.com or AllAboutJack.podbean.com. If you have questions or comments, email them to info@EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, that's info@EssentialCSLewis.com.